Duck, duck, goose! The Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon.
And this is Patrick Jackson.
And this is the Duck of Minerva podcast. If you could increase the gain on your side, that would be awesome because you sound, well, maybe I can just.
Well, hang on. Let me.
No, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You know what the problem is? The volume on my system is really low. Because I was blasting. I was listening to Riptide, and I had some of the. Anyway, are you a Beirut fan? Probably not. I would imagine it's not your kind of music.
I don't know that I've heard of a band called Beirut.
Well, their first album was Gulag Orchestra, which the caption was something like the greatest indie pop band of the 19th century. and Maya calls them mumble rock. It's kind of, you know, it's it sounds very retro 19th century. And he sort of goes, rah, rah, rah. But but I like it, and the albums just keep on getting better, I think. Sometime
cool.
I'll play them for you.
Having gone to see Yes on Saturday night, I'm on a Saturday Yes kick right now, so that's what I've been blasting all day, to the great amusement of my assistant next door, who occasionally sticks her head in and is like, what are you listening to?
Yeah, I think people who believe that we share a brain probably need to understand that our musical tastes are radically different.
Yeah, pretty radically different. I mean, we have certain things that we will agree on, but as our general go-to, I think it's very different genres.
But I think even the things that we agree on, so, you know, for example, I think we both are reasonably fond of the Decemberists, but you like their prog turn, and I don't.
Right. Right. Whereas I think the stuff they did on Hazards of Love was some of the most brilliant stuff they've done.
Right, so. And I found it pretentious and somewhat boring. Yeah, there's some good stuff there. Anyway.
So, this is a whole separate conversation we should record at some point.
Oh, we're recording it. I'm so ready. You know, it's so. Last night I did an interview with David Herter, who is, I think, one of the best science fiction authors that not enough people have heard of.
Mm.
And I'm hoping that this interview will move some of his books, which are available in ebook format. And one of them is a 3-novella sequence. He calls it the First Republic trilogy because they take place in the Czechoslovak Republic between the First and Second World Wars, and they involve sort of famous authors and composers, and they're really, at least I got about a third of the way through the first one, and I was very disappointed because I wanted to finish it before I talked to him, because I was interviewing him about an older work, ostensibly. But anyway, so I sort of was trying to get him warmed up, so I was asking him questions about the First Republic trilogy and about the first book, On the Overgrown Path. And I suddenly realized that we were doing the interview. So I just kept recording.
Right.
And so I'm now trying to figure out how exactly I'm going to wrap it properly.
Right. Well, at least you've got some good material. That sounds interesting. I've not read that. I'll put that on my list.
Well, the book that you really should read first is Ceres Storm, which he came out, I think, in 2000 or 2001, but has been re-released. I think you would really like it. He's very influenced by Gene Wolfe.
Okay.
So it has a lot of Wolfe's. And it's funny because I sort of read it and I thought there's really the shadow of the fifth head of Cerberus going on here, even though. It's very different in tone, and in fact, he said that The Fifth Head of Cerberus is his favorite book. And it has, and in fact, he when he was at Clarion West, Gene Wolfe was his teacher, right? You know, the writer's workshop. Anyway, you should definitely read it.
Cool.
What do we want to talk about today?
I don't know. I read Red Shirts last week, and it was awesome.
Yeah, I have actually not read Red Shirts, so maybe we should not discuss Red Shirts then.
Okay.
Last time we had talked about, and I'm not going to use what we're talking about now. I thought when we were doing the music riff, we might use that, but maybe I'll intersperse that in or something.
What you have to intersperse it with is two quick musical cuts from things that we were listening to.
Right. Well, that would assume I had Yes to intersperse it in with.
Oh, believe me, I can take care of that.
I'm not excited about this. So, ding, 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 ding.
trying to come up with the appropriate intro music.
So what we've decided that we are going to talk about today is the end of IR theory. And part of the reason why we want to do that right now has to do with some exchanges, Patrick, that you've been having on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, it was a rather interesting experience to be clued into this blog post that Felix Berensgaute posted as a guest post over on Disorder of Things about the end of IR theory. Now, this was Felix's reflections on and thoughts after a set of panels that were organized at the last ISA meeting, organized by the editors of the European Journal of International Relations to try to answer the question, has IR theory ended? Are we at the end of IR theory? And part of why I was kind of struck by this was because after that conference, I mean, you and I weren't involved in those panels, but then Colin had invited us to contribute a piece, possibly for the special issue that they want to produce. And in the course of writing that, we had hit upon an argument or an observation that a lot of the debate about the end of IR theory seemed to be a... How shall I? Well, you know what? We put it more kindly in the piece, but I'll put it a little more bluntly in the podcast. There was a lot of older folks, established scholars, pining for the halcyon days of the late 80s and early 90s, in which supposedly there was lots of IR theory, and now it seems to have all gone away because the field doesn't look like it looked at that point in time. And that argument that there was some sort of generational gap or generational split going on here, that the end of IR theory question looks very different if you're of a different scholarly generation. That turned out to be a large part of the observation that Felix made. And I had also reported that other people at the conference, including Janice Bialy-Mattern, a couple of other scholars, had made the same kind of observation. And I was rather struck by that. Simultaneous independent discovery is something that I think is kind of interesting. The fact that they hit upon that, and the fact that, you know, when you and I wrote this piece, as we sometimes do, we weren't quite sure what we were arguing until we started writing the piece. But that was the thing that seemed to make the most sense in terms of the ambiguity of this whole end of IR theory question, this generational aspect of it. So the fact that both we and Felix and apparently some other people of our same scholarly generation had made this observation is something that I find really intriguing.
And the other side of this, of course, is that when we first started working on the paper and talking about the end of IR theory. And by the way, the paper is preliminary entitled Icahn Has IR Theory,
yes,
which should be kind of a giveaway about what some of our punchline is and
yes,
our attitude. Gosh, I don't know if the paper's going to make it through review, and I certainly don't think that title is. So maybe we'll have to go back to, you know, It's Life, Jim, but Not As We Know It.
I really hope that we get to keep that title, though.
Well, I'm going to give a talk at Berkeley called Icahn Has IR Theory in about a month and a half. So, but okay, so one of the things that sort of struck us was that we weren't really sure what people meant by IR theory when they talked about the end of IR theory. And so we tried to work through a sort of combination of deductively and inductively what that claim might mean. And we came up with a couple answers. And those answers then informed some of these observations. So one of them was that you could, by IR theory, mean the paradigm wars.
Right.
The isms, right? So you could mean that we are not spending enough time talking about constructivism, realism, liberalism, and so forth, or we do not have a new exciting ism to drive along the conversation, or the isms have stagnated, right? Those would be kind of your – it was great back in the 90s when we were arguing about these big theoretical questions, and now we're not doing so.
Right.
The second interpretation we came up with, which is sort of similar but subsuming, was that people were missing – we don't have a great debate now, right, that captivates large percentages of the field. So you don't go to conferences and have people arguing in the hallways about the same thing because they attended some knockdown, drag-out battle on some big issue or debate that everybody has a stake in or everybody knows about. And in this reading, the paradigm wars of the 90s were just one iteration of those great debates. So what people are really missing is the excitement, the sense of vibrancy that comes from discipline-wide argument, right? The third version was just, you know, middle-range theory, that people aren't being theoretical enough in their explanations of things that they're finding in the world, right? And we actually think that that kind of theory, you know, sort of the kind of weird synthesis we have now, where it's, you know, you have a correlational finding, you are supposed to then present a theory about why that occurs, and that theory makes references to a set of causal mechanisms that, for sociological reasons, we all kind of accept. So you can invoke audience costs, and even though now there's a big debate about whether or not audience costs are a valid mechanism, people go, oh yeah, okay, it's an audience cost argument, we get that, or some other form of credible commitment argument, or maybe a collective identification argument, or whatever, these sort of off-the-shelf mechanisms. And if you think that's what theory should be about, then theory is actually doing really well, which, because that, in fact, it may be doing too well. There may be too much of a demand for people to buttress empirical findings with theoretical claims. And regardless, that's why people like Duncan Snidel think, you know, look at theory and they say, what's the problem? We're doing great. We've got these very nuanced debates over, you know, kind of rationalist accounts of foreign policy outcomes and stuff. Was there another understanding of theory that we thought might be at work here?
No. I mean, we had our own alternative after we put forth those three, which was gets into this distinction between philosophical and scientific ontology. But I think that our diagnosis, at least of the debate, was that people seem to mean one of these three things by the end of IR theory, and their diagnosis about whether IR theory is doing well or not depends a great deal on which definition of IR theory they're operating with. So if you're operating with the first two, the paradigm wars or the great debate, then IR theory looks like it's in shambles. And if you are operating with the middle range theory / standard stories kind of account of theory, then it looks like it's in pretty good shape.
Yeah, and then we said some snarky things about those.
Us? Snarky? Really? Never.
Right.
We don't say snarky things in articles.
Never. We would never bury snarky comments in footnotes or allusions to sci-fi geekery or anything like that.
Never. We would never do that kind of thing.
Never, ever. Which is an open invitation, by the way, to look through our footnotes and our indices.
Yes.
So, because we really just think we're so clever, don't we?
Very much. We're incredibly clever.
But I mean, we were snarky, but I think in an honest way, which is to say that the paradigm wars really weren't all they were cracked up to be. They didn't involve the field to the extent that people think they did. The things involved weren't paradigms, which is an argument we make in ISQ in a 2009 article. And that otherwise, you know, if you mean paradigm wars, yeah, that is in decline. It's not clear that that's such a bad thing in of itself. And it's not clear that the paradigm wars were this glorious moment for reasons intrinsic to paradigm warism, right? And I think with respect to the great debates argument, we really kind of use the new historiography on that and say, that's interesting. These great debates are retrospective constructions. They weren't that great, and they weren't very much of a debate, right? So they're like the Holy Roman Empire, which in fact was Holy Roman Empire, but that's another story. And then we offer this other alternative, which we think is really where the interesting stuff is happening, which is this idea, as you mentioned, of IR theory as being about scientific ontologies. Maybe you should elaborate on that.
Yeah, and this is a distinction that I've been quite happy with, having picked it up out of context from some stuff that Mario Bunge had to say, that Heikki Patamaki and Colin White brought in. It's actually where I first found this particular distinction, was in an ISQ piece they did a number of years ago. But basically, the distinction between a philosophical ontology being a set of claims about the relationship between the observer and the observed, so thus speaking to issues about the epistemic status of claims that are made, and a scientific ontology, which is more what we think of as sets of substantive claims, sets of catalogs of what kinds of things exist in the world and what's out there to be theorized. And the distinction that we draw in the piece is an instinct that I'm increasingly comfortable with, is that when we talk about theory, what we mostly mean is scientific ontology.
Well, I think I would amend that a little bit. When we talk about international theory or international relations theory, and we want to sort of have a consistent excavation of the logic, then we mean scientific ontologies of international politics, or at least we ought to.
Right. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, it's not the case that we presently actually all do, but we should, and that's what theory, international theory, should mean. Rival scientific ontologies of international politics, or of world politics, broadly understood, or whatever we want to use to characterize that. The thing, though, about a scientific ontology is that it's not simply a description. A scientific ontology is, by virtue of being a scientific ontology, is a set of ontological claims with explanatory value. So when you say things like, we have a scientific ontology of world politics that's primarily about sovereign states interacting in anarchy, that's not simply a descriptive claim. That is a claim that these are the features of world politics we should be focusing on. These are the kinds of implications one can draw from that. These are the ways in which you use this to explain different sorts of things. And the interesting thing about the distinction between scientific and philosophical ontology is a scientific ontology, a theory which is about enumerating objects in world politics, is analytically disjoint from a methodology, which is to say how you might go about evaluating those claims. So you can take a claim like international politics is composed of sovereign states interacting in anarchy, and you could treat that as a falsifiable hypothesis, but you could also treat that as an ideal type. Right, you could treat that as and those would have implications for how you would evaluate the claim, but not necessarily for the content of the claim itself. So the scientific philosophical.
So just to be clear, you wouldn't falsify the claim that states are acting under anarchy unless that was a derivative theoretical claim from a more fundamental scientific ontology. But you might have theories that would derive from that proposition that could be falsified.
Right. There are different ways of cashing these things out, depending on how one takes a particular set of substantive claims and translates them into a given methodology. The important point here is that the two are not reducible to each other. So one could say, for instance, I agree with Waltz's substantive claim about what's important in world politics, but I disagree with the way he goes about evaluating a statement and using it for explanatory purposes. Or one could say, I really like Waltz's methodology, which, as we've both argued, is sort of an ideal, typical, configurational approach, but I don't like the specific content of what he comes up with for his account of what the international is.
Now, we should be...
Both of those two are sort of valid options.
Right. Now, one of the things... I don't remember our exact catalog, but we do actually... We should make clear that we have a fairly broad understanding of what could be part of a scientific ontology. So it's not just, you know, what actors populate the international system. In fact, I've already then smuggled in a set of claims that might be scientific, ontological, and character. So I think we talk about not only actors, but what actors are important, but what the nature of actors and actorhood is, how they relate to one another. So do they relate to one another in systemic terms, in interactionist terms, in relational terms? You know, right. What is the way in which they fit together, as it were, and that they fit with then other elements of the catalog of properties of interest, and then also things like, you know, what are the fundamental units of analysis, and that might not just be sort of states, which is the way we often talk about it, but it might be, no, we're studying processes or causal mechanisms, or we're looking for correlational relationships. Wait, now I'm snuggling methodology, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I mean. What I mean is, you know, sort of, is the world made of processes? Is it made of substances?
Right.
That sort of thing.
Right.
Is the fundamental unit of analysis a practice, a behavior, an action? That's what I meant. Yes.
Right. That is what you meant. And should we be starting to cut in at the level of actors, interactions, system-wide aggregates? Those would be claims that would fit within scientific ontology.
So yes. you would both have kind of a general framework that that is still not philosophical ontology, but is scientific ontology, which could be fairly abstract, right? It could be relationalism or practice turn stuff, or it could be a kind of Foucauldian, the world is kind of made up of Foucauldian discourse. type stuff, or it could be, networks or what have you, right?
And
then you might have specific then claims that would still be at the level of scientific ontology about, you know, what the specific kinds of networks, social sites, actors, et cetera, that are of interest and that are fundamental to theory building.
Right. And the important point about the scientific and philosophical ontology distinction is one could take that kind of, let's just run with a network account for a second. Here is a networked picture of how things are. Here's what we think about as how we define ties. Here are nodes within networks, so on and so forth. One could then plug that into a set of regression equations and see whether or not positionality trumped other variables. And that would be one way of cashing that out.
Which is pretty much what people are doing, majority of people are doing who are applying social network analysis tools to international politics.
Right, right. And then, but by contrast, you could also do something which, and here's great historical irony in the field for you. If you go back to, even before Cohen in 1977, you go back to 72, go back to their initial articulation of transnational relations, and they're not proposing these things as hypotheses about position. They're proposing them, I think, or at least one could argue, they're proposing them as a different kind of ideal typical baseline against which to measure what's happening in world politics. And so you could, instead of testing for positionality and how that affected behavior, one could say these are the kinds of relations in which things are enmeshed. Let's apply that to specific cases and see whether and to what extent particular kinds of flows end up concatenating to produce particular outcomes in certain cases.
So
method, you could cash out basically the same scientific ontology through very different methodological lenses.
All right, so if you'll forgive me, then this is the stuff of scientific ontology, and this is the stuff of what constitutes international theory or international relations theory.
Right.
And we argue that if this is what we mean by international theory, it's doing okay, right? The big exciting thing right now in some circles is the practice turn, and that's a debate about an alternative scientific ontology, which is related to or embedded with or in dialogue with some other ones, right? So a lot of the practice turn as it's currently discussed is in dialogue with claims in other forms of constructivism about who's got the right scientific ontology for understanding the socially constructed character of international politics,
right,
and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, it's a sort of robust debate about kind of what are the primary things that we look at when we look at international relations. There's also, you know, our kind of hobby horse, which is much more marginal as an articulated program, but that's, you know, relational approaches. There are still a lot of people who are using a kind of structural realist scientific ontology, even if they're not doing structural realism the way that Waltz did it. There is open economy. There's the open economy approach to international political economy, which itself is a set of scientific ontological claims, which are closely related to Merevchikian liberalism, but not identical to. So there's a whole set. You know, the English school has become, you know, Barry Bazan's been very successful, and his collaborators, in pushing renewed attention to the English school, which really is fundamentally, in its modern variant, a scientific ontology, a set of propositions about how we ought to think about international relations being put together. So there's a lot going on there, and we think, you know, that's cool. There is a lot going on there. But we also think there's something rotten in the state of, ISA?
ISA. Something. Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of a good it's, 'cause it's not Denmark. It's certainly not Denmark's fault. But
Although securitization theory probably is, but anyway.
Yeah. that's a separate ghost that continues to haunt things.
Anyway, what did we think was kind of off here? Like, we think on the one hand, you know, that there is a kind of a good prognosis here. But on the other hand, we were a little skeptical. We thought something might not be.
Yeah. And this is, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure how clear we actually were in the draft. And when we get some comments back on it, we may need to be sharper about this. Because I think the main problem here is, because we don't think clearly enough about the distinction between scientific ontology and philosophical ontology, we, and by we I mean sort of the field in general, tends to couple these things together as if a particular scientific ontology could only be cashed out through a particular philosophical ontology. So you get English school claims about the character of the international, which are then received by mainstream U.S. scholars, especially the sort of open economy politics folks, as alternative hypothetical propositions which should be tested against their version of things, when there is no reason why every substantive claim about world politics should be a falsifiable hypothesis. That's a separate methodological issue. But because the folks who articulate the more sort of open economy politics version of things are by and large, I think I would even say 100% of them are neo-positivists, they're interested in doing hypothesis testing. That's the only way they understand alternative claims. And then you get the counter reaction to that, which, or I guess it would just be the reaction to that, from folks who are not interested in that kind of neo-positivist hypothesis testing project, which is to say, well, forget any approach to methodological or methodologically sophisticated, methodologically rigorous evaluation of claims. We're just going to say stuff. And then you end up with theory that presents an alternative scientific ontology having little or no methodological apparatus. And so you get this weird dichotomy where on the one hand, you've got highly articulated methodological procedures for evaluating claims that are linked to one very specific set of claims. And then you've got a whole universe of other sets of claims with no methodological apparatus for evaluating them.
And then the papers that try to bring them together are often, as you suggest, forced to conform to a particular hypothesis testing procedure. Which may be appropriate for some of the derivative theories that come out of those international theories, the mid-range theories that derive from the international theories or the scientific ontologies, but which the scientific ontologies really can't carry the weight of So if I wanted to sort of make an if I wanted to do an article saying or another article saying, oh, we should get relationalist, right? And I wanted to try to get that into IO or ISQ or another leading journal, quote unquote, or in fact many journals. I would probably then be forced to write out a set of meta-theoretical propositions. You know, this is what relationalism is.
Right.
And then either I'd be forced to test those meta-theoretical propositions, those scientific ontological propositions, which is frankly impossible, mm-hmm. right? And then so much of the paper, or I'd be forced to then present a derivative theory, right?
Right.
That
right.
then could be tested. And then from that derivative theory, I'd then be forced to engage in a set of hypothesis testing. And wait, I had an 8,000 to 10,000 word limit there?
Right.
Well, that's shot.
Right.
So if you actually look at a lot of the relational stuff that's come out that is really self-consciously relationalist, sort of like Stacey Goddard's work, it doesn't really carry the meta-theoretical apparatus on its sleeve, which might not be a bad thing, but it means that people don't really know that it's contributing to this relationalist research program and that there is this really interesting scientific ontology behind it.
Right.
So that's part of the problem. But another part of the problem that we thought, which ties back into what Felix has said, is that there's a reason why we feel like we're spinning our wheels here and that there isn't a lot of progress, and why there's and part of that, as you suggest, is that the people who are doing really careful scientific ontologies have sort of said, I don't like neopositivism, so I'm not going to talk about, you know, they don't tend to do a good job of saying what it is, why they're, what empirical kinds of propositions or empirical kinds of questions or logical problems in the study of international relations their scientific ontologies are tended to solve, right? So we get these sort of elaborations of scientific ontologies with no implication, right?
Right. Exactly.
And even you and I, who love reading this kind of stuff, read that and are like, and we should care about this. Why?
Right. Right.
The flip side of that, or the other side of that, we thought is that when people are forced to or consciously choose to explain why their theories matter, there's a problem with the theories that they're comparing them to or the theories that they're drawing upon.
Right.
Segue, right. Patrick? Prompt, prod.
Wait, I'm sorry. Back up and do that exit again.
Okay, yeah, that was a very poorly performed segue. Look, what I was going to say, look, let's...
Turn left. No,
your other left.
exactly.
Well, let's not be cagey here. Our argument is that we should shut up about the same damn international relations theories that we've been talking about for 15 or 20 years, or at least not accord them the degree of privilege that they get. Right. One of the reasons why we spin in circles is that we have dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, if you go across all of the journals and all of the other outlets for IR theory, of these scientific ontologies. And who are they arguing with? They're arguing with Ken Waltz and Alex Wendt, maybe Barry Buzan, possibly, if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. Maybe now they're going to start arguing with Vincent Pilliot and Emmanuel Adler and Ted Hopf and a couple of the other practice term people. But basically, they don't argue with one another, right? So you have this kind of core periphery intellectual structure in which a couple of canonized theories sit at the core. Everybody in the periphery argues with them. So, of course, there's never any progress because none of the really interesting sort of next generation scientific ontologies are doing anything to improve one another or to fight with one another in a productive intellectual way.
Right. Right. Exactly. So you just end up with endless repetitions of the same basic things. And it may in fact be the case that in principle, a text has an infinite amount of meaning to it, but I'm not sure that in practice there's too much more blood you can wring out of the stone called theory of international politics. It's been pretty definitively gone over. I mean, people need to stop genuflecting in the direction of these very small sets of claims, very restricted sets of claims, and open their eyes a little bit. Part of the problem, of course, and this is where it gets from the philosophy of or the intellectual account of the content of IR theory to more of the sociological conditions under which IR theory is produced. There are just so many bloody journals out there. And there are so many interesting places in which IR theory, if we think about it as scientific ontology, is being done. Just that very few of them are the places that were on people's radar screens 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. The number of journals has expanded exponentially. There is this thing that Al Gore invented since a lot of the senior generation of IR theorists was in school, this thing called the internet. I'm sure people have heard of it. And that means that there is this massive proliferation of blogs and podcasts and other sorts of fora in which these things happen. You know, I think that more interesting IR theory is actually done on duck and disorder of things and you know, sometimes a crooked timber than is done in a lot of the mainstream journals. The barriers to entry, the barriers to publication, not just the word count thing, but the strange game of having to please a whole series of reviewers. And the more prominent the journal, the more they try to be fair and equitable by spreading out your reviews among reviewers who don't agree with each other. So you end up with one reviewer saying, I love this piece. And one reviewer saying, this is crap. Don't publish this. And so then they say, oh, deadlock. Fine. We're not going to publish it. And what ends up getting through is sort of stochastically distributed, right? So IR theory is being done in all these different kinds of places. The reason why we called the piece, right, I Ken Has IR Theory, is in part to signal that we need to expand our view of not just who is doing IR theory, but where they're doing it and where the appropriate kinds of debates are actually happening. They're not, for the most part, happening in the same old places. And if you just looked at the same old places, then you would pretty clearly define IR theory as being somewhat languid.
Yeah, so a lot of where the piece winds up, and I think our thinking on this has wound up, has really been at this level of sociology and practice of the field. And it's not just so we talk about it, as Patrick mentioned, you know, we talk about the proliferation of journals and the way that's, we think, you know, on the one hand, you'd say, great, because, you know, now there are all these outlets, right? Not just journals, but also, you know, self-publication of various forms, et cetera. But on the other hand, we think this is having a kind of power law effect, right? As information overload sets in, you maybe have, you know, communities scholarly communities who are very specific, and they might really pay attention to Millennium, or they might really pay attention to, you know, the Journal of Peacekeeping Operations or what have you. But people don't have time to sort of survey everything, so it's paradoxically made IO and World Politics and a couple of the quote-unquote leading journals more important. At least that's our kind of wager. The same way, in fact, the proliferations of blogs seems to have had a power law distribution effect on the prestige and traffic in the political blog sphere. Mm-hmm. We also then talk about the peer review process, and Patrick's done, I think you've done a nice job of explaining that, but I want to go a little bit further because we really start to draw upon work that's, we draw upon some work and some writing that's been done on peer review that really suggests that there are reasons why innovative scientific ontologies should have a lot of trouble making it through the peer review process, right?
Right.
They tend to be kind of often they're high risk but high reward kinds of pieces, right? Which is to say, most of them are probably not going to have a tremendous influence in the field, but the ones that do are going to far outweigh other kinds of pieces. They also are likely to have controversial claims in them. They're also likely to run into sort of people who say, why am I wasting my time with this? And so we argue it's sort of another reason why it's incumbent upon reviewers to be, you know, kind of more willing to countenance things that they disagree with, right?
Right.
But it's also incumbent upon, and also not demand that to get published, you have to cite a couple of canonical theorists plus, you know, the reviewer's work.
Right.
But on the other hand, scholars who write this stuff have to really do a much better job of communicating why we should listen to them. We also, I think, then talk about the generation gap issue a bit, and we suggest that some of this might be demographic, that, you know, again, it's a much more exciting world for IR theory of the type we talk about if you are in a position in your career when you're reading a lot of stuff. When you haven't made it yet and you've got a kind of passion for advocating your particular approach. And so those of us who are kind of hitting 40 or over 40 might be more kind of settled. And so we look out and we don't necessarily, you know, want invest the energy we should in both trying to find and then trying to read material that deploys theoretical propositions that are unfamiliar to us, or that we may say, you know, we've seen this before, but instead of dismissing it, say, you know, well, okay, maybe it needs to be said again, or maybe there's something interesting that's different that's going on here.
Right, right. And so in a way, it's, we're sort of, we're on the cusp of being part of the problem. Because there it does come a time where it's just with your professional obligations and stuff, it's just a lot harder to keep up with things. It's harder to do this, particularly now that there's more pressure to publish, not just at the junior stage, but even once you have tenure, that you just have to keep publishing all the time now because of these productivity measures. I mean, obviously our British colleagues know more about this experientially because of the whole, what is it called now? Is it now the REF or the RAE?
I know it's got an R and a vowel in it. And that's,
yeah, that whole crazy process of evaluating people's productivity. And now of course in the US, you know, it being the US, it's not going to be implemented top down. It won't be a government thing. It'll instead be a quote unquote private enterprise thing. Its name is academic analytics, and it will start being used increasingly by provosts and deans and stuff to evaluate people for promotion and raises and so on and so forth. So the incentive is all on the side of publish more, don't spend so much time reading and thinking, just get stuff out there, go, go, go. And the challenge is how one avoids falling into that. And I think you really have to be very deliberate about it in terms of saying, no, I'm actually going to carve out time to seek out things in unfamiliar places. I'm going to go to panels at conferences that are not my normal thing so that I can get a sense of what else is going on out there. I don't know, I think about it, this is sort of what the International Studies Encyclopedia was kind of supposed to do, like here's a bunch of stuff. The problem is it's just so freaking huge. I mean, it's not like anybody's going to sit down and read the International Studies Encyclopedia cover to cover to see what's going on in the field.
It also can be fairly idiosyncratic, and it's never going to be up to date. I mean, it's a great resource, but
oh, it is, but it doesn't serve as one stop shopping for what's now happening, and it's hard to figure out what that would be. Maybe there isn't such a thing as one stop shopping for what's happening. And I don't know what we do with that. I mean, when you combine that with the incentives to publish more and read less, it becomes a lot harder to see what we're going to end up with or what we could end up with that's anything other than with that illusion that Alex Wendt uses at one point, the isolated archipelagos of theory. You know, people who we referenced Denmark and securitization, Copenhagen stuff earlier. You know, the folks who do Copenhagen-style securitization theory know each other, read each other's stuff, and sort of do their own thing. There's a way that the trail for this was blazed by the world systems theorists, right? Because who in IR, other than world systems theorists, has heard anything from the world systems theorists in like the last 20 years? They're still there. In fact, they have robust debates in their own online journals. And they have their own little subparts of conferences where they kind of talk to themselves. And they do great work on their own terms in their own little isolated spot. And I mean, that one possible vision for the future is that it sort of it all looks like, right?
Well, but you're sort of taken, as am I, by the writings that Kuhn was doing before he died, when he kind of backed out of the Kuhn that we know and started making some different kind of interesting claims, particularly his view that rather than paradigmatic shifts and revolutions, you have disciplinary speciation.
Right.
And which is a very fancy way of saying that, yeah, that's probably the future, right? This is what quote-unquote progress in a social scientific or natural scientific enterprise looks like. It looks like the development of niche communities.
Right.
But that then returns us to the point that if you want to have a conversation that can bring in people across the field, you've got to have robust discussions and debates about scientific ontology, because that's the point where everybody has something at stake and everybody's got commitments that they're making in their research that it would serve well if we were to excavate and talk about, not just from time to time, but on a fairly continuous basis. But I do think I want to emphasize, I mean, for us, I think at the end of the day, there are whole, if we take as given and we're not convinced it is true that IR theory is facing problems, then virtually all of the mechanisms that might be at work in accounting for those problems are exacerbated by the emphasis on counting publications and
right.
on publish,
right.
Which is why I think our concluding subsection is something like, and while we're at it, can we have a pony?
Yes, exactly. Because it's one thing to point out the problem, and it's another thing entirely to actually come up with a solution. And I will freely admit that I do not know what the solution is.
But I will say that the interesting side of this, and we're both running out of time, so this might be a kind of open question.
Yeah.
Is the implication of new media, social media, blogging for the field? I mean, I just, you know, I had that post recently about the Sage email that went out, you know, where I was kind of like, oh my God, I remember when blogging was something you weren't supposed to do.
Right.
And we had to justify it. And now it's all about, you know, a way of self-promotion. I do think we really, Charlie's opened this up nicely. There have been some panels. This is an ongoing conversation that really needs to happen. What does it, you know, there are dimensions of this that range from open access to the kinds of things that EIR is doing to the kinds of things that, you know, we've been involved with on the margins for a long time. But, you know, what is all this kind of, what is all this production of intellectual energy that doesn't go through the normal channels mean for the field? And I think we think we need to take it more serious. We think that we need to take it more seriously, but we're not sure kind of what that looks, the nuts and bolts of that would look like. I will say that I never thought I'd be saying this, but I've reached the point where I really started to be peer reviewing pieces where I think, this would have really benefited from reading Dan Dresner's blog post on this.
Right.
Or this really would have benefited had this person done a Google search and discovered what the Disorder of Things has to say about this. Or, wow, Phil Arena's writing some really interesting stuff that bears on this on his blog. But, you know, of course, there is not a single URL that is not to a newspaper article in the article.
Right. Right. And then I wonder whether this is just a generational thing. I wonder how much the professional socialization structures and incentives are relevant here. I wonder how much of this is just going to be utterly destroyed when people realize that there is much more interesting stuff going on out there, and you don't have to do, you don't have to do the same kind of conference presentation, the same kind of conference paper, the same kind of teaching as you've done. You can actually incorporate some of this technological stuff. But then I wonder whether there's not going to be a backlash. I don't know. I'm very unclear as to what the future of this actually looks like. I think it's unquestionable. I would agree with you. There are times when I'm reviewing things when I think, goodness, you know, here's somebody who really needs to spend a little bit more time, you know, reading. If you're engaging Eikenberry's argument, why don't you read a couple of Eikenberry's blog posts over at Talking Points Memo Cafe, where he actually elaborates on these things, and then you've got something a little bit more substantial to deal with. Or the debates about liberalism, which sort of assume that that, you know, the last, that only the stuff that Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote in a book is what she thinks about this, as opposed to things that have come out more recently in these more non-traditional outlets.
Like her, like her Twitter feed, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, and I tried a little experiment with this piece on relativism, which came out of the ISA BISA meeting, where Yale Ferguson organized this great panel on diversity and global diversity in IR. And I wrote a piece, sort of had half written it before I got there, and then I kind of outlined it to do the presentation, and then came back and filled that in and made a piece out of it about philosophical relativism, and about why I think the problem of philosophical relativism is often overstated in IR, and why this really isn't as big an issue as we think it is, and there's more opportunities for communication and so on and so forth. And I looked at that, and I said, well, you know, I mean, I could take this, and I could, the language is a little informal, but I said, look, I could formal this up, add in some more references to things, and I could send it to a journal someplace, in which case it would be several months before I would get a review, and I can guess that the reviewers would probably split about a couple things, and depends on who they send it to, what the result would be, and then I have to work on it some more, and yada, yada, yada. And then I said, you know what? I'm a full professor. I'm an associate dean. I don't give a crap. I just want this out there so people can read it. And the folks at EIR had been interested in me publishing something with them. They'd asked if I could do a response to one of Cohane's speeches that he gave at Aberystwyth recently. And so I said, here, and I gave them that. And then we syndicated it on Duck, and I did it in three parts. And I bet, I haven't actually done the comparison, but I bet that piece has gotten more downloads and more eyeballs on it than most of the things I've written in formal publication outlets.
This sounds like a good place to close out, because I'm sure that in the future we can talk more about the big question, peer-reviewed publication, House of Cards or Organized Hypocrisy? And we can talk about this whole kind, really the what we're finding about eyeballs and readership in even small blogs like ours versus how many people actually read academic articles. And I've mentioned that in some blog posts that, you know, people can go look at. But it is really startling. You will be read by a lot more people if you go to even a niche blog than if you publish in a, you know, decent journal.
Right. So, right.
All right. Let's call it a day for then, or for now, day
yeah.
for them. You can tell that my lack of sleep is catching up with me through my deteriorating comprehensibility. But it's been good talking to you, and we'll do this again soon. So long.
Sounds good.
You have been listening to Duck of Minerva, podcast number 4, recorded on 10 August 2012. And now, your moment of yes.